We want to welcome our guests. We're glad you're here. Delighted you've come. We want to do you good and no harm. And we choose to do that by simply opening the pages of what God has said by His prophets and messengers, and let Him speak for Himself. Tonight is the night when I set off in the world of PowerPoint. But I tell you, if anything goes wrong, I'm going to attribute it to my managers who have been directing me at these things. Tonight, it's going to be a distraction, I can guarantee you, because I'll be thinking about this instead of what I'm doing, but we'll get better at it as time passes. You've been very patient. Please continue to be so. Tonight we're continuing our study of the letter of Paul to the Ephesians. Powerful as the scripture is, touching all the facets of life, nothing left out. We sing together, "This is my Father's world." And it means more than the manifestation of His presence in nature. It means that His will touches every aspect of human existence in this world, and that He rules providentially over every moving, living, and even inanimate thing. We had an excellent lesson this morning on why the Bible is reliable. And not to suggest it was incomplete in any sense, but to apply what I feel is most important for us, because many of us will forget all those things. And we won't be able to tell how many manuscripts there are. The Word of God itself is one of the most powerful evidences of its origin, because it reaches to the roots of the human soul and makes us know as we read it that whoever produced this thing knew who I was and where I was and what I needed. So never fear to take the Bible and say, read it and see for yourself. And that's what we're doing as we study this section of Ephesians. Paul is in a series here that began with verse 21, subjecting yourselves to one another in the fear of the Lord. And then there are three relationships that he addresses: wife to husband, and husband to wife, children to parents, and parents to children, bondservants to masters, and masters to bondservants. These are relationships where the stress of application of the truths of the gospel will be most apparent. That's the reason they're addressed. The Apostle Peter, in his first letter, took up these matters as he spoke about suffering for those who follow Christ. He mentions another. He mentions the relationship of the Christian to the civil government as a point of stress. And it is. For they represent the power of the culture more than any other thing. But he also speaks about the relationship of the Christian spouse to the one who is not a Christian. And he also talks about servants and masters, at least about servants. This is a troublesome part of the writing of the New Testament. We would like to begin this study by saying slavery is wicked, not to be tolerated, should be everywhere denounced, and yet there is not one denunciation of slavery anywhere in the writings of the Apostle Paul. Only one little one in his writing to Timothy, where he includes man-stealers among those who are ungodly. Those who steal men in order to sell them. But slavery is accepted in the New Testament. And that's bothersome, isn't it? In this country, we have a rather dark chapter of slavery, where men and women are treated not as human beings, but as chattel, something you own, like a piece of land or a horse. It was ungodly in so many ways. And we wonder, as we read this passage, where he addresses himself not to hired servants, though the principles, I'm sure, would apply, but to bond servants who were owned by other men. Let me just say that there were plenty of hired servants, we know, because Jesus mentions them in his parables. All the servants in this world of the Greeks and the Romans were not bond servants, but he addresses bond servants. And I'm wondering to myself if he does that in order to make his point from the most onerous kind of situation. Bond servitude in the New Testament world. Just a quick preview. Then we get to PowerPoint. In the Greco-Roman world of the first century, slavery had eased in its most onerous features. You go back to the years before, the three centuries preceding the birth of Jesus, when Rome was expanding itself across the whole of the Mediterranean world and beyond. And they were conquering armies all over the place. And they were taking people captive all over the place. So that slavery expanded almost exponentially. Just slave upon slave upon slave. And a lot of them were taken into agricultural settings where they were forced to labor as slaves. Let me tell you, it didn't make any difference what your education was. It didn't have anything to do with class warfare. If you're taken prisoner in a war, whatever your previous skills and abilities, now you become the ownership of somebody else. But by the time of the first century, it was not quite so bad. I think because slave masters had learned if you treat your slaves well and treat them in a commendable fashion, they'll work a lot harder for you and be more useful. The interesting thing, I think, for us is we read about a case of a Roman centurion, or an Italian Roman soldier, centurion, in the city of Capernaum, who had a servant, and the word is bond servant. He had a slave that was dear to him, 7th chapter of Luke. So dear to him, when that slave became ill, desperately ill, and he knew that Jesus was known to cure such cases, he sent for him. So you see, it was possible in the world of that time for a slave to be so dear to a master that he would do anything for him. We also learn in the 18th chapter of Matthew about another bondservant slave who was a slave of a king. He was a sorry individual. But the story of Jesus says that he owed, through mismanagement or through stealing, a king's ransom to the king. And so he didn't know what he was going to do when the slaves of the king were being called upon to give an account. And so he decided he'd just fall down on his face and beg for mercy. And amazingly enough, the king forgave him all this mismanagement, all this grievous misuse of funds. But what I want you to understand is slaves took up very high positions. They were not just down there doing menial tasks in the field. That was the world of the first century. And many slaves became freedmen. You remember that Roman governor that Paul preached to? Who said, as he heard it, or who felt as he heard it, he felt a terror. When I have evil conveniences, he said, I will call for you. That man had formerly been a slave. I'm saying all this so you get the picture. It doesn't take away from the fact that many people were they were tragically abused in slavery. I don't know if this answers for us the question of why apostolic writers did not come down hard against slavery. I believe I understand why. But you have to judge for yourself. Look at what Paul says here about the duty of Christian slaves. This is written to Christians, remember. And this is the duty of Christian slaves. And when he addresses masters, this is the duty of Christian masters. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that there were slave owners and slaves in the assemblies of first century churches. Slaves have been converted. If I were to tell you what I think about it, and I'm going to, I would tell you that I would think that a lot of slaves were converted because they had so little to offer them in this world. And the common people heard Jesus gladly, and I have no doubt that the apostolic preaching of the cross was a message of hope to them. Jesus was an humble individual when he walked here in the flesh. A carpenter's son. He did not hold high position. And he treated all alike. I am not of the impression that Jesus had anything to do with slavery. I'm not under the impression that the apostles had anything to do with slavery. The only servants mentioned were the servants of Peter, Andrew, James, and John, who were in the fishing business, but the word is hired servants there. They were not bond servants. We have no information that Paul was ever connected with slavery in any way. But when the gospel went out, a lot of slaves were converted, and now we know some slave masters were converted too. And there they are sitting in the same assembly. And they're in the church in Ephesus. And Paul is addressing them. He doesn't say to the slave masters, release all your slaves. He doesn't say to the slaves, you have no business being put under this kind of bond servitude, just leave as quickly as you can. To the contrary, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 says something that teaches us that not only in Corinth, but in other places, there were slaves present as well as those who had been freed. You can't find 1 Corinthians in Romans. Chapter 7. Where he speaks about this matter of slavery. Verse 21, were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it, but if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Doesn't make any difference what your situation is here. In the Lord you are free. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. I have titled this lesson, Slaves of Christ. Because it really doesn't make any difference whether you are a bondservant or you are a slave master. You're both of these people are slaves, bondservants of Christ. And that's the point being made here. When we began this study, we said we must all be in subjection to one another. Husbands and wives. Parents and children, masters and servants must all be in subjection to one another. And we ask then, what do we mean by that? What did Paul mean by that? He meant that each party of these duos must be concerned for the other more than for himself. That we must subject our own wishes, our own desires, and make them suit the needs and desires of others. That is hard business. It means the death of the ego. But this is a hard word. You're a slave sitting in the audience when this letter is read. And you're told in no uncertain terms you are to obey them that are your masters according to the flesh. And that according to the flesh has been italicized here for the simple reason that that's the limitation. They are your masters according to the flesh, but that is as far as it goes. You have a higher master than that. But that higher master, says, obey your parents. Obey your masters. And notice the spirit of with fear and trembling. In sincerity. Not with eye service as men pleasers. With good will doing service. But I think it's important that we recognize that the motive of the Christian slave's obedience is not fear and trembling toward his master in the flesh. It is not with a great desire to serve him and because of who he is, because he's in charge. That wouldn't have sufficed to produce this kind of attitude in view of the fact that most of these slaves of the Christians had pagan masters who didn't care for Christian principles, who had not been influenced by them, who lived into the culture. And so he stresses this fact as he does with the question of the husband and wife, as he does with the question of parents and children, that every last one of them is working as unto the Lord. And so, here again and again in this series, verse 5, as to Christ, you will work with fear and trembling. I believe the fear and trembling is with regard to the Lord. As bond servants of Christ, verse 6, doing the will of God from the heart. How many times does he have to say this? Well, evidently it takes a lot because we don't seem to get it sometimes. As to the Lord, verse 7, with trust in God that he, if not the master, will reward them. You will have to wait for him to reward you. You will do this in faith. You will do this with the recognition that the master may treat you badly and may never recognize ever the kind of servant he has and never give you the reward due to you, but you will await with confidence the reward that Christ will give. And there's one other thing. This comes out of 1 Peter. Paul doesn't so much address it in his letter. But Peter's talking about suffering. In the second chapter, and verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear. Not only to the good and gentle, here it's specific, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And then he makes the most powerful appeal. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no sin, nor a deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled did not revile in return, when he suffered he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. That's what Paul said to you. That's what he said about submission to your master. You're trusting in God. And you're remembering that the one you serve also suffered unrighteously and unjustly. And that you are called to walk in his steps. And that particular application is made in direct connection with the responsibility of the bond servant. Well, you know, as I read this, I thought to myself, The slaves get most of the exhortation, and here the masters get one verse. And I'd have thought that the masters ought to have gotten plenty of exhortation. Wouldn't you? Well, maybe they get more than we think. Paul seems in this particular case simply to return to what he's been saying. Maybe more, it's more than just what he said to the servants, the bondservants, but what he said to everybody through this series. He says here, and you masters do the same things to them. In other words, you're going to have the same attitude toward your bondservants as I've exhorted them to have toward you. You're going to have to look upon them even when they are difficult. You're going to have to look upon your guidance of these bondservants. You're going to have to look upon your relationship to these bondservants as Christ would have it. As Christ would have it. As He deals with you. As He presses the point here. Knowing that your own master also is in heaven. And there is no partiality with Him. It won't make any difference whether you're a slave or a master. The same rules apply. The same love, the same rules of love and grace and justice and fairness and righteousness will apply in your case as it does to your bondservant. So it seems to me that the whole load of what He's already said to the bondservants is now falling on the head of the master. And as it should. As absolutely should. Forbear threatening. You know how bosses are. They like to get upset and tell you what they're going to do to you if you don't straighten up and fly right. Paul says, don't do that. That is not an expression of love or grace or wisdom or anything close to it. So remember, you'll give an account to your master in heaven. Colossians 4:1, which is also read here tonight, adds, give your bondservants what is just and fair. That would mean that you'd really take them into account. You would really take them into account when you began to deal with them as your servants. Now we get the application. You know, you wonder, how can admonition to slave masters and slaves have any relationship to a world like ours? How does that have any relationship or applicability to people who work freely in the jobs they take? And the answer is, yes, it can. Sometimes we think the Lord just didn't think ahead far enough, you know, and He made all these statements that only apply to the world in which He lived. And He didn't anticipate this modern world of ours when we have so many advances and so many different situations. And I can't tell you the number of commentaries I've read that have that as their basic theme. This is good stuff, but it hardly applies to us. Sometimes we run from the truth. Keeping your commitment to your employer no matter what. Wouldn't that fit here? Doing what you ought to do for your master, slave master in this case, you just make the transition here. It means you ought to do what you said you would do for your employer when you hired on. And you say, but listen, he's unfair, he is obstinate, he is just absolutely unjust in so many ways. That's his affair. Your responsibility and my responsibility as an employee is to do what we committed ourselves to do when we hired on for the job. Our employer's behavior does not affect our behavior on the job. That's a great temptation. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, I'm not going to work hard for this company. They don't do a thing for me. And I'm not going to go out of my way to help anything on it. I'm not going to do anything beyond my absolute minimum. Just to hang on the job. That is what kind of attitude. That is unchristlike.
Don't ever let those words or that sentiment pass from your lips. It may sound to you like it's only justice that I do that.
But you have been urged in the principle that we've been looking at to do everything you do as unto the Lord. Is that how you want to deal with Him? Is that how He's dealt with you? Giving you the minimum? As unto Christ, as unto God, doing everything earnestly and genuinely and with a happy spirit. I know people go to work sometimes, and I am sure that when they get on the job, you can tell from the look on their faces that they'd rather be anywhere else than there, and they're doing whatever they're doing grudgingly. And I know the spirit and attitude of your employer may want to move you in that direction, but remember, you are not working for the employer ultimately. You are working for the Lord. You are His. And He's called upon you to do this for His sake. Can you not do it for His sake? Can you not put a happy face on and take up the task even if you're not appreciated and do it well because you want to do well for the Lord? So that anybody who knows you as an employee, as a worker, will say that individual takes his work seriously and does the job well. So the Christian employee is working for the Lord and therefore in His service. What are Christian workers to do when the employer is unfair and dishonest? Find other employment. We're free to do that here. That's an option for us. It's not always a convenient option, especially when jobs are scarce. But we are not bound to our task, and we can find other employment if it's our wish to do so. We don't have to do that, but it's open to us. Appeal through legitimate avenues for better treatment. There are legitimate avenues set up in many industries, in the management worker relationship, where appeals can be made. And somebody says, yes, but you don't ever get anything. I make appeals, but when you make an appeal, they put a black mark beside your name and you'll get rough treatment thereafter. Well, that, again, leaves the first option open. But what about labor strikes? That's always the question. I don't know any case of where the New Testament speaks about a labor strike. I think that needs to go into the record. But are there any principles here that might govern this? What about labor strikes, primary strikes that had to do with your contract with the company? What about sympathy strikes that don't have a thing in the world to do with your contract with the company you're working for, but you want to go out and strike to help others who are on strike? I'll just say this to you. That the principles of the will of God have to be applied to all these things. Do they meet the standards set up by the Lord? I'll just ask this question right now because I think this is what it's about. Is it right for laborers to join together and bargain as a group for the price of their labor? What could you say against it? Certainly laborers have the right to band together and to bargain for their labor together. There was a time in the history of this country when owners of businesses treated their workers with absolute disdain, and there was a grave amount of injustice committed against them. And that's the reason that the workers banded together. They bargained for better conditions. But is it right for those workers who have banded together to bargain with their employer for the price of their labor, is it right for them to achieve their end by violence or intimidation? Is it right for them to stand belligerently in front of the gate
and shout abuse at anybody who goes through. In what way does that reflect the Spirit of Christ?
But you say, well, but that'll kill the labor movement. That's not my concern here. And I don't think it was Paul's concern or the Lord's concern.
Our concern as Christians must be not whether we're going to succeed or fail so far as the labor movement is concerned, but our concern has got to be whether we're behaving ourselves as those who are the children of the living God and the servants of Jesus Christ. That has got to be the issue.
Must the Christian worker consider the problems and needs of his employer? I believe this text says he must. I know it's a little difficult to consider that when you're dealing with an impersonal corporation. That's, you know, those are not people. That's just a corporation. It's just a conglomeration of hard-hearted people who care for nothing more than how to make a profit, and they don't care how many of us get ground down in order to achieve it. I mean, I'm not going to rule out the possibility. Any more than I'll rule out the possibility, the probability that a lot of slave owners in the time of Jesus and the time of the Apostle Paul in the early time of the early churches were absolutely horrendous in their treatment of their servants. Peter indicates that it's likely to be so. But we are Christians. There are other problems, I know, practical problems. Some companies have closed shops. Which simply means that if you want to work for that company, you have to be a member of the union. Other companies have a more open situation where there is a union, but if you choose not to be a member of the union, you can do that. I don't know whether you can fail to pay union dues or not. Sometimes you are required to pay union dues, whether you're in the union or not, in those situations. But I will still say to you, the ways of the Lord must govern our attitudes and behavior, whether we're inside the union or out. And in every activity in which we're engaged as employees. And somebody said, well, what about these bosses? What about these companies? What about these harpists? And I tell you, some of them are actually, they're dishonorable. They will sign a contract and it'll still be enforced, and they will suddenly announce that they're not going to abide by it. Or maybe they won't say it. They'll just not abide by it. And they expect the employer to swallow it. You want a job? This is what it takes. You say we didn't keep the contract, we say we kept the contract. See our lawyers. You see in court. I know those things happen. They're unjust. And no Christian who is a part of management, no Christian who is standing in the stead of the base employer of the company could ever be a part of that kind of dishonor. And if we should be, we have denied the Lord. We have brought shame upon His name. We have behaved as the children of this world. And it's not going to fly with the Lord. Your master above is going to call you to account for that. Every employer needs to think of the needs of his employees and be always fair. I would say it's more than that. As best you can. I know sometimes there's a limit to what you can do because there's no money, because the market is stiff, and because the competition is horrendous, and you're struggling just to stay afloat. And I think workers need to take that into account. The problem is that the relationship between workers and management has been so polluted and poisoned that the workers believe that the only reason that the management says that is because they're trying to intimidate us and they got all kinds of money in the bank. And the management believes that the only reason the workers are out there striking and saying we're not treating them right is because they want more money for less work. Just a bunch of
deadbeats, trying to make money off of us when we're struggling like we are just to keep our heads above water. Those kind of attitudes may exist when one party in this kind of axis is not a Christian, but it cannot exist when both parties are Christians for sure. And when they're not, then we just bear the burden. Suffer for the Lord's sake. And keep His principles. Conclusion. You can get through in a hurry with power. Keeps you to the point. No pun intended. Life in the Lord influences our behavior in all aspects of life. That's one that got eliminated there. I'm going to put that in. And we have to apply them in all aspects of life. You can't come here. You can't come here and take your place in this assembly and sing the songs and pray the prayers. Read the Bible with serious intent, really. I mean, you've studied your lesson. You want to get it right for the class? If after all, when you've done all that, in these significant relationships of life, it may be between husband and wife, or it may be between parents and children, or it might be between master and servant. The failure to apply the principles of the gospel to those relationships will cost you heaven. Never forget. And coming to this assembly, won't outbalance that. See what you get to see? That's free. We'll master that part of it later. But I hope you got the lesson. I hope you heard what Paul was saying. I'd be glad to talk with you about anything I've observed, and you may find me grossly ignorant of labor-management relationships. Extremely naive about those matters. But let us agree on this. We've got to apply these principles in our life out there in the workaday world. And people need to see us as people who subject themselves to others for their sake, for their benefit, and serve the Lord Christ, even when it's to our disadvantage, to do so. I know there are people in this audience here who are not Christians. How my heart aches for them. And will continue to ache. I know some people are like the man who told his friend, he said, "I don't want you to mention the gospel and Jesus to me anymore." We can't do that. He has put too deep a care in us. The issue is too profound for us just to stop. It doesn't mean we have to nag you continually. I don't think that's ever been very effective. But it does mean we're going to go on caring and praying for you and longing for you and hoping against hope that you won't wait so long that you get hard. Because when you get hard against the Lord, you get hard in a lot of places. You just get hard. And you cease to be the kind of human being that God intended you to be. And you do His will. We won't invite you now. That's all the Lord could do, and that's all we can do. He said, "Come. Come to me, all you that labor and heavy laden. And his invitation is powerful because of what he's done for you. I mean, he is the slave. He has been the slave. He has stooped to wash our feet. He has emptied himself for our sake. And I don't think there's any more you could ask of him. Is it too much for him to ask of you? Come to me, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. For I'm meek and lowly in heart. You shall find rest to your soul. You who are not Christians and never confessed Jesus, why don't you come now? This young man did in the morning. And those of us who are Christians, but our lives are awry from these great principles that we've talked about tonight, you'll have a lot of sympathetic souls if you come forward to say, look, I got a lot to repent of here, and I have misbehaved myself before others. And I seek the mercy of God as I've asked him to forgive me, and I'm asking you to pray for me. Why don't we stand together and sing the invitation hymn and answer?